Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 298. How can you easily reduce the size of a Python Docker container? What are the exceptions you should catch in your code? Christopher Trudeau is back on the show this week with another batch of PyCoders Weekly articles and projects. We cover a tutorial by Quinn Tron at CodeCut about shrinking the size of a Python Docker container. The piece explores Slim Toolkit, which analyzes a container at runtime, identifies what files are used, and then builds a minimal image with only those dependencies. We dig into a recent piece by Trey Hunter about Python exceptions. When trying to determine a strategy to handle potential errors, which exceptions should you catch and which should you leave unhandled? We also share several other articles and projects from the Python community, including recent releases, two PEPs that have been deferred to Python 3.16, a critical vulnerability in an open-source ASGI framework, resolving a lazy import manually, a project to anonymize sensitive PII data, and a tool for loading Django settings into a TOML file. Today's episode is brought to you by Ori by Endor Labs. If you're using an AI coding assistant, there's a good chance it just introduced a security vulnerability into your code. Ori gives your AI agent the security context it needs to catch flaws, flag exposed secrets, and block malicious dependencies for free. Check it out at the link in the show notes. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, Christopher, welcome back.
Hey there.
All right. We got another lineup of news. I'm going to cover one little news item myself, our typical topics and some projects this week. Are you ready to dig in?
Let's do it.
All right, let's go.
So we're starting out with some release news. First off, Django 6.1 alpha is out. This is their feature freeze for the 6.1 release. And Django typically releases at the end of the year, so this will probably come out in December. This version has a couple of interesting database control features. First, the ability to specify how fields in a model get fetched, giving you finer grain control over how prefetching works. And the other is a new way to control foreign key cascading deletes, moving the logic that is already there from the ORM into the database when the database can do it, which will make it a little more efficient, a little faster. The second release I wanted to mention is Nootka 4.1. Nootka is a Python compiler which takes your code and generates a runnable binary instead of using the interpreter. There's a lot in this release. It's a fairly big release. Similar to like how PyPy works there, it takes them a while to catch up. So they're currently compatible with 3.13.
Yeah.
And this release includes experimental for 3.14. So they're trying to get there.
Have you used it? I'm just wondering.
I have not. I haven't had the need to do it yet. So
Yeah.
There are a couple other just-in-time compilers that are a little easier to throw together. And so the few times that I've needed something, that's been the path I've gone down rather than this one. So
yeah, it seems like a very geared toward the performance end. And so I think it might be maybe narrower.
That's the intent. Yeah. I think that's the intent. So moving on from releases, two quick notes in PEP land. First off is PEP 8.13, which is titled the Pretty Print Protocol. You may have used Python's pprint command to pretty print a dictionary or something like that. This PEP expands the capabilities, defining a dunder pprint method, so that way you'd be able to create pretty print compatible objects. This one was slotted for 3.15, but it's been deferred to 3.16. The other PEP that was updated is 8.30, titled Add Timestamps to Exceptions and Tracebacks. We mentioned this one just a couple episodes ago. It's also been deferred. This is the outcome of the feature freeze that happens with the 3.15 releases. There's going to be stuff that just didn't clear the bar.
Yeah. Beta just came out, right? So
yes. And I believe you had some vulnerability news you wanted to share.
Yeah, I saw this one in passing, and it was just
right after the Pycoders issue had come out. And so I think, well, this will be useful. We're a little slow too, the way that we record and then the episode comes out. But I thought it was important enough. We're covering a lot of AI topics here off and on, at least I am, on a variety of things. And this was one I think maybe might slip your mind because it's sort of a foundation for a lot of tools. I'm first going to share an article by Dan Gooden, who's from Ars Technica. It's detailing the recent critical vulnerability that's present in Starlet. And I think we've mentioned Starlet a few times, especially I think you mentioned very recently, maybe it had just gone to 1.0. It's very popular. It's used, said like 325 million downloads per week. And it's a framework that implements ASGI, A-S-G-I, Asynchronous Server Gateway Interface. It's the base of FastAPI, which we've mentioned often on the show. And so that's very important. And there's many other Python frameworks that are kind of built on top of it. The primitive, they now track it as CVE-2026-48710. It is branded bad host by the discoverers. It reaches a really large segment of Python AI tooling ecosystem, VLLM, which is where they discovered the bug, FastLLM, LightLLM, text generation interface, most open AI shim proxies, MCP servers, agent harnesses, eval dashboards. You get the idea. Bad host carries a severity rating of 7 out of 10, and the piece includes a link to an online scanner that you can use to check if your given server might be vulnerable. The crux is that Starlet accepts invalid host header values that cause authenticating apps that use Starlet's request URL object to approve unauthorized access requests. I'm going to provide a link to the update and the fix that has already been addressed, but it will expose a lot of different types of data in your system potentially. Everything from, you know, identity verification stuff, IoT industrial SSH devices, emails, depending if you're hooking up your LLM AI type tools to this type of thing. Yeah, you may want to look for this vulnerability. So version 1.0.1 addresses the issue and it's been released, and I'll include a link to that. I just want to mention it partly because a lot of people install these entire stacks of stuff and maybe don't know like what is underneath that and is building it. So make sure you check it out and get updated. All right. So I guess that gets us into topics pretty quick. My first piece is actually from Trey Hunter, who we've featured often lately. It's on his Python Morsels site. It's titled, "What Types of Exceptions Should You Catch?" The premise is it's a good idea if you're going to catch exceptions that you know where they're coming from and maybe understand like why and when you would want to catch them. He shares a piece of code that's parsing some dates that are coming in from a CSV file, and it has a try except block with four exception types in it. It's one of these things where he puts all of them in there to show off what it would do and then take you through what's happening. As he goes through the scenarios of when and why each of these would be raised, he starts with name error. In this particular case, it's not a good practice, partly because a name error would be something that would probably try to catch a bug that would be from the way you've written something, and you've misspelled in your code a variable name, unlike the type of thing where you'd have a try except block where you're trying to catch from the data the end user is bringing in. It's, again, more likely that it would suppress that bug that you've written. As we go, I thought it might be helpful to include sort of a definition for each of these that goes a little bit further. RealPython has this whole glossary element now. I'll just read off those definitions as I go through them. A name error occurs when you try to use a variable or function name that isn't defined yet. Like I said, what would be the case there would be you might have tried to use the name again and maybe misspelled it or had a typo or something like that. So the next one he has in that block checking is a value error. This makes a lot more sense. In this particular case, an exception would be raised if the CSV data had invalid data in one of its rows. In this case, he has an invalid date and he's showing off in this particular row that there's a date that's 2026-00-01. So maybe it got entered in as like a off by one error or something like that, but there are no months with two zeros. Defining from our little glossary, value error would get raised when a function or operation receives an argument of the correct type, but its actual value isn't acceptable for the operation at hand. That one makes more sense in this case than type error. So this example, he has some rows where, along with having the dates that are in them, there's a few values that are just missing. It's just a blank entry in those particular columns for that row. And in that particular case, a type error would be what gets caught. This particular object isn't going to match, you know, what it was looking for. There's no type there at all. So a type error occurs when an operation or function is applied to an object of a totally inappropriate type. So what about a key error? In his example, if there is a problem with the header, such as a typo, the CSV has a column header, in this particular case, with a capital letter when the program is expecting the names of these columns to be all in lowercase. It would then show a key error for each of the rows in the data file, which is a little confusing. There aren't problems with the rows. It's actually the entire column is mislabeled in the sense that it has the wrong key. So that might be a little confusing as you look at it. I like these kind of examples. They're some of my favorites of like, let me show you something failing. Let me show you like all the different things that can go wrong. And I think Trey does a good job of that here. So a key error occurs when you try to access a missing key in a dictionary. This usually happens if you're trying to retrieve or delete a value using a key that doesn't exist. Again, this isn't a problem from the data in each row. It's actually a problem with the header. So he argues that it probably makes more sense to not catch the key error there at the top, but to rewrite the code to catch it preemptively. So not as part of this loop that's looking at each of the rows of the data. He provides some code where it's actually checking the header and the details of each of the headers and finds out which one would be then in an error. He shares a final paragraph about when should you catch all possible types of exceptions, like he was trying in this case. That's not a common practice. I think you would normally want to narrow it down to the types of things that you're looking for, when and where. But he has another good example here, a code example where it's looping over a bunch of file paths. And in that case, there could be a variety of things that could be wrong with the files as it's going through. And he doesn't want it to sort of stop and halt as it finds one particular error. It would be nice to have it go through and see if there are any other kind of problems with the other files as it's looking through. The example he shows is that one of the files couldn't be read because there's a permission error. And then there's another one that has an encoding error. And those would be different things that you'd be capturing there. So it's a nice tour of exceptions. And again, kind of where and when to place them. So thanks, Trey. And if you're looking to learn a little bit more about built-in exceptions, RealPython has a nice course for it. And I'll probably tie it as the video course for this week.
He didn't touch on one of my peeves, which is accept pass.
Okay.
I think that should be a compile error.
Oh, really?
There is no reason to, you need, at bare minimum, you need a comment that says what you're doing there, because essentially you're saying, I would like to ignore an error, and you really should be explaining to somebody why. There needs to be something there. And in production code, it's usually logging something, but even in just little partial scripts for yourself, you better put something, because you come back to it and you're like, oh, well, we'll just ignore it. It's fine. It's almost never fine. There was a reason it accepted in the first place. So
yeah, bad practices. A quick word from our sponsor, Ori by Endor Labs. Here's the problem with AI coding agents. They're great at reproducing patterns, but they struggle with context. Studies show they only write code that's both correct and secure about 20% of the time. Ori fixes that. It plugs straight into your AI code editor through MCP, so your agent gets real security intelligence while it writes. It catches vulnerabilities, spots exposed secrets, and blocks malicious dependencies, all in your existing workflow. The developer tools are free, and you can get running in under 60 seconds. Head to the link in the show notes to try it. So what do you got for your first one here?
Well, PyCon US 2026 wrapped up just a little bit ago, and this time of year becomes Christmas for linked-based newsletter editors, because there's lots of content that comes out of the conference, including this one called PyCon US 2026 Packaging Summit Recap by Bernard Gabor. Along with the conference itself, PyCon is where a lot of the core developers get together to talk about upcoming things in Python and the ecosystem. The Packaging Summit had several speakers all talking about new things in Python packaging, including a variety of PEPs that have been proposed over the last year and a half. Python packaging PEPs, say that five times fast.
Yeah.
The first talk Burnett covers is by Emma Smith, who is a core developer. She was one of the people involved in adding the Z standard compression library to Python and wrote PEP777 that outlines a new format for wheels, which includes using the speedier Z standard. The second talk was by Mike Fiedler, who is the safety and security engineer at the PSF. He spoke about the growth of PyPI and how the number of projects added per month has grown by three times in the last 2 years, except the amount of infrastructure and the number of people handling it has not grown by that. Normally, growth is a good thing, but it's also symptomatic of things like malicious packages being uploaded. Some of that growth is actually from people trying to game the system. So Mike talked about a variety of things being done to help control this. For example, there are now tighter rate limits on the number of new projects that can be uploaded per account per day. This used to be 40-some, and now it's down to like 4, which seems reasonable. I don't think anybody's moving that fast. Also, the improvements to the trusted publishing mechanism has helped control who is doing what in the system as well. So if you're doing a larger project with more contributors, taking advantage of trusted publishing means keys are being exchanged and makes everything safer for everybody.
Mike was on the show in episode 177, so a little while ago, but it was nice to talk to him. It was at the time when he just came on as PyPI's safety and security engineer. So if you want to learn a little more about Mike and what he's doing for PyPI there.
Yeah, they're doing some good work. And of course, this protects all of us. So that's a fantastic thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was also a conversation about how long things should stay at PyPI, which is currently 36 terabytes in size. This isn't just about resource management because, you know, disks are cheap, but also about how attackers use URLs for entries that have been moved to cold storage. So there are some proposals about maybe doing some garbage collection on this kind of thing in order to try and produce fewer attack vectors. Hosting packages has also become more complicated. This is a slightly exaggerated case, but you could, in theory, have a Rust binary installing a Python package that ships a Go binary that invokes the Zig compiler. Probably not one of those yet, but you get the idea and it is possible. There are ongoing conversations about whether PyPI should be a CDN or not, and if not, how do we move those binaries to somewhere that can be basically binary storage and reference to them? So there's ongoing conversations happening about this kind of stuff. Those were the two talks that I wanted to highlight. There was also one from Aram Khan about Conda distributions and several Lightning talks, one of which was on the Packaging Council, another one on mobile packaging, environment management, and loads more. So if you want to learn the latest and greatest about packaging, this summary is a great source of information.
I want to note that disks were cheap.
True. They're far more expensive in the last few months, but they're still cheaper when you think about a cents per gigabyte of what we paid.
Back in our day.
Back in our days when we were chiseling it onto stone wheels directly. Yes.
Yeah.
Dinosaur tooths made it expensive.
What was your original hard drive size? The first one you ever had bought?
It was either a 10 meg or a 25. I can't remember which. Yeah.
That's megabytes, guys.
Megabytes, yeah.
I think mine was 40. Yeah. That's so crazy to think about. Yeah, for my Atari ST back in the day. All right. Well, speaking of storage size, I have a piece from Quintron at CodeCut. It's titled Shrink Your Python Container in One Command with Slim Toolkit. So if you're deploying a Python application and you're using Docker images, those images tend to contain more than probably your tool needs at runtime. And so this article is going to take you through a small example application, setting it up in a Docker container, and then figuring out how you could probably slim it down so that you could save on distribution and potentially disk use and so forth. It uses a command line application. It's called Slim Toolkit that I mentioned before, and it strips unused files out of the container image. It uses two steps to do that. There's a static analysis initially that goes through the image's contents without running it, basically kind of taking an inventory of, well, what is all there? And then a dynamic analysis is the second step. Now it actually then runs the image and then tries to see which are all of the files that are actually used by the app. So again, list everything that's in the image and then figure out what's actually used. The example application she uses is a chatbot, which uses Chainlit, L-I-T. It's an open source framework for building LLM chat UIs. It has a web interface and also does the message handling. And then the other tool that she's using in this example application is the OpenAI SDK, and it's calling out to GPT-4.0 Mini. So she takes you through this code example that is pretty simplified. It's mainly just sort of setting it up and then setting up a couple messages to kind of show you what's involved there. In this particular case, it's all running local just to kind of show off the tool. But once you have the application up and running, you pin the dependencies to a requirements text file. In this case, it's Chainlit in OpenAI. And then you create a Docker file. That's going to build your image. So do you specify in that? Well, you're pulling down Python colon 3.11 slim as a base Docker image, and then installing the pinned dependencies, copying the app.py into it, the application, and then starting Chainlit on port 8000 when the app runs. So that's, again, just sort of describing what's all in the Docker file. And then you build the image, and it ended up being around 300 megabytes. So the next was to find out, well, how slim can you make it with Slim Toolkit? Takes you through some of the CLI commands and how they work. The tool inspects this large image, starts it up in a sandbox, and then sends a git command to probe and record the files in that the container touches. And then it auto builds the new slimmer image containing only those files. There might be problems with that. Again, I like these kind of tutorials. You may not realize all the things that are happening functionality-wise, that a single get command isn't going to run everything in that. It only loads the UI shell in this case and doesn't actually start the chat messaging back and forth. So it did make a smaller image. It was about a third of the original size, but it failed to run, which because it's missing some of the other key components from Chainlit. So she does a second pass with a few more commands, including a call to actually do some back and forth, and then adds in her case, oh, I should include the entire path for Chainlit and its package. So now the slim image, once all that's done, is down to about a half of the size of the original. So about 160 versus 300 megabytes. Wouldn't fit on our old hard drives. The last portion of the tutorial digs into what was removed. There's a command line that you can do that's a slim x-ray, and when it runs it, it will show you all the different stuff and kind of where it comes from. So there's a lot of OS stuff. It's running a Linux distro in this slim version of the, you know, Python image that they have there. So there's like Perl and apt, some Python build tools, like setup tools comes sort of with Python and ensure pip, and then a few other little parts here and there. I caution this. deployment pipelines, saving time and bandwidth and overall storage size, great. But you're going to be missing a lot of things that would be useful if you have to troubleshoot anything. Potentially, I need to update the image I'm using. Oh, well, you might have to totally recreate everything as opposed to updating it on the fly because now you don't have that stuff there. So just a caution, you may not want to throw out the lifeboats, food supplies, and all the toolkits when you're doing this, depending on how you're trying to deploy something. If it is just all about a smaller size, you may just want to, you know, be cautioned a little bit there. But I think it's an interesting idea, and I'm looking at doing this type of thing of deploying some stuff and potentially using Docker. And yeah, some of the things that come automatically, even from images that are themselves called slim, can be a little bit bloated depending on what you're trying to do. So it's nice to know that there's a tool out there for that. So thanks again, Quinn.
It's like us, relatively slim.
Exactly. Well, can you run that on me? Wait, what are you going to throw out? It's time to shine a spotlight on another RealPython video course. And it digs into one of the topics we're covering this week. A Python program terminates as soon as it encounters an error. In Python, an error can be a syntax error or an exception. This course is titled Raising and Handling Python Exceptions, and it's based on a written tutorial by Saeed van de Klundert. Your video instructor is my previous guest and core RealPython team member, Martin Broyce, and he takes you through how to differentiate exceptions from syntax errors, how to use the assert keyword to check if a certain condition is met, how to write custom exceptions that subclass the built-in exception class, how to catch exceptions with a try except block, and how to use the additional keywords else and finally. And you'll practice catching built-in exceptions through the code examples. RealPython video courses are broken into easily consumable sections, and where needed, include code examples for the techniques shown. All lessons have a transcript, including closed captions. Check out the video course. You can find a link in the show notes, or you can find it using the search tool on realpython.com. What do you got next?
What I've got next is actually two related articles. Both are things I've learned posts by Rodrigo Jarl, who you know is a nice guy because he tolerates my constant butchering of his name. Python 3.15 is introducing lazy importing, a way of allowing you to import a module without actually causing any of its side effects to happen until you need the module to run. This should help improve performance for modules that load lots of other modules but don't necessarily use all of their components, particularly things like command line tools where you've got like subcommands, and those subcommands might load modules, and you know, if you're only using one of them, you don't need to load all of them, that kind of situation. Rodrigo's first article shows you how this works by creating a little module that defines a function and prints to the screen as a side effect to being loaded. When you use the new lazy import mechanism, you see that the module got loaded, but the print doesn't happen until you actually call the function in the module. Or if you inspect the module, say by printing it out, that also triggers its full loading, which kind of makes sense, as any use of the module is going to trigger completion. What the TIL article is actually about is the fact that you can see that it's lazy without triggering it, though. You can directly inspect the reference in the globals dictionary, and that will show you that it was lazy imported, and you can see that without actually, you know, doing something like printing it, which would trigger the loading. So it kind of gives you this way of looking at it before it happens. The article I actually came here to talk about, though, is his newer TIL, which covers the resolve method. If you look at one of these lazily loaded modules, you'll see that it has a new method called resolve. When you call that method, that returns the fully loaded module. So if you're tinkering around, you can actually keep a reference to the lazy module and the resolved module at the same time. Resolve is the underlying mechanism that Python uses to fully load the module. So when you use something in a lazy loaded module, Python is calling resolve for you, then replacing your original reference to the lazy module with the fully loaded one, but you can get at the internals. So it's kind of neat to see what's happening under the covers here. And, you know, as usual, Rodrigo always has some good stuff.
Yeah. We went from slimming down to becoming lazy again. It's weird.
Yes.
All right. That takes us into projects. I think people will find this tool useful, especially if you're working with large amounts of data. In today's age, people are very concerned about not sharing information that was not intended, the PII, or personally identifiable information. That's a mouthful, hence why they use PII. My project is titled Presidio. It's Data Protection and De-Identification SDK. This is from Microsoft, and it was fun reading the documentation, which is rare, just even the beginnings. I'll go through a little bit just so you're familiar with some of it. Presidio helps to ensure sensitive data is properly managed and governed. It provides fast identification and anonymization modules for private entities in text and images. It is fully customizable and pluggable, can be adapted to your needs and be deployed into various environments. There are a lot of warnings in this doc. With triple exclamation points at the beginning of them, like, grab your attention. It's kind of this, like, we made this thing, but we are not making promises about your data, which I get. So note, triple exclamation point, Presidio is a library or SDK rather than a service. It is meant to be customized to the user's or organization's specific needs. Then the warning after that, triple exclamation point, warning, Presidio can help identify sensitive PII data in unstructured text. However, because it is using automated detection mechanisms, there is no guarantee that Presidio will find all sensitive information. So consequently, additional systems and protections should be employed. So it's a sweet It's actually a whole bunch of little packages that you can use and sort of building blocks that you can kind of tie together. The first is Presidio Analyzer. It's a package for detecting PII entities in natural language. Then there's Presidio Anonymizer, which is for manipulating those PII entities in text, meaning like remove, redact, hash, or encrypt. There is the Presidio Image Redactor, which is for detecting PII entities in image using OCR. Presidio Structured is a package for detecting PII entities in structured or semi-structured data. So that's like, you know, data frames or some other things that you would be working with where, you know, it's not just individual text. So why did they create it? Their goals were to allow organizations to preserve privacy in simpler way by democratizing de-identification technologies and introducing transparency in your decisions, embracing extensibility and customizing to a specific business need. The authors and maintainers of Presidio actually come from their industry solutions engineering team. They work with customers on a variety of different problems, and they found that this was a key issue they had with proper handling of private and sensitive data and a challenge they had. So again, triple exclamation point, Microsoft Presidio is not an official Microsoft product. It's installed using pip, though they have instructions if you want to use Docker, going back to that. It supports Python 3.10 to 3.13. You install the Presidio-Analyzer and or the Presidio-Anonymizer packages. But you also need to include an NLP engine. That is something that might go past a lot of people going through this. You should be using something like Spacey, Transformers, or Stanza, some type of NLP engine underneath it. The documentation is really good, even though it has lots of warnings, like I was saying. I think they did a nice, thorough job here. And if you're looking for a tool or you're working in an organization that deals with PII and potentially needs to kind of go through and clean up some of that information for reporting or whatever it is, it looks like a really useful tool for that. So I wanted to make people aware of it.
I just finished doing the video for the built-in functions in Python, and one of the sections is on exec and eval. And I think it's 3/4 warnings, don't do this, and 1/4 actual lesson. So yeah. So I feel their pain.
Are you using so, the 3 exclamation points? Note!
I have biohazard signs and skull and crossbones and lightning bolts.
You got extra visual mediums than just text.
That's right. Exactly. So. Nice.
So what's your project here?
I've got something called DJ Toml Settings, which is by Adam Hill. For those not familiar with how Django works, when you launch a project, Django automatically reads a file called settings.py, which is needs to be there in any Django project. And it imports all of the variables inside of that file and uses them for configuration. For example, there's a setting that defines what databases you're connecting to. Yes, plural. That Django does allow multiple connections. And how you connect to them, like, you know, usernames, passwords, ports, all that kind of good stuff. So a consequence of this is that you're loading a module, which means your settings.py file can actually do more than just define variables. I actually sometimes take advantage of this to change the configuration based on reading environment variables or loading secrets from text files. The downside of this is that your configuration is executable. This isn't as problematic as something like setup.py, since it's all contained within the project which you control, but there are arguments for things like multi-tenant deployments where it's better for architecture to separate the configuration from the executable code. So what DJ Toml does is it allows you to load Django configuration settings from a Toml file. So it supports using both your pyproject.toml and a specific file called django.toml by default. And then, of course, you can add your own if you really want. And the Toml format maps very nicely to the kinds of things that you would find in settings.py, allowing for, you know, regular variables as flags, lists, and dictionaries, and all that kind of good stuff. One of the beauties of settings.py being a Python file is that you can reference other variables in it because, you know, code is code. So, for example, it's very common to have a single definition of the project location, which you can then reference later as like the base directory when you need to know the location of files that are relative to the base directory. So DJ Toml Settings allows for something similar. You can use dollar brace formatted strings to reference other values, and it will fill in those variables as you go along. So you're getting some of that power that you get from having plain old Python. There's also a special section which allows you to load on based on environment variables. This triggers so that you can have, say, define an environment variable for whether you're in dev or production, and different kinds of settings will get loaded depending on what that is, which is a really powerful tool. So documentation is pretty comprehensive, and it includes examples of working with Nano Django as well. If you haven't come across it, Nano Django is a project that allows you to build a Django project in a single file instead of using the usual hierarchy of directories in a project. So this is a pretty neat project and combines some ideas from other attempts at this problem into one place. So there's some good work here, and if you're looking to up your settings game in Django, this is worth checking out.
So just to clarify something on the settings file, being that I'm diving into Django often now, it's going to keep all the fundamental elements that are in that, and then this allows the sort of things that you would normally be going in and customizing on top of that.
Yeah.
You're not moving everything over into this file.
No. Yeah, you configure settings.py. You add stuff to settings.py anyways. Django looks for certain things in there. So, for example, the database configuration, it expects it to be there, and things are going to go awry if you don't have it. But you can also define your own flags for your own purposes. So what DJ Toml settings just allows you to do is to do that in addition. So I probably wouldn't move everything over into from settings.py, but I would might maybe use it where I've got some stuff for dev and some stuff for production, because then I...
Yeah, that totally makes sense.
Then I can separate those things out,
much easier to switch instead of like having two settings files.
So like I've got a shim that I use where I've got like I will put a directory named secrets, and then I put it in my gitignore not to include that directory, and then any keys and things like that go into that. And then I've got two lines of code inside of settings.py which will read that out. And when I've built projects for multiple developers, I've even had the thing where it'll like read from that directory, and it'll look for your username and load a file that is basically, you know, ctrudo.py for my personal settings. And that allows each developer to do different things for their machines. So this would allow you to do that in some sort of TOML file that you could keep separately. And that would keep your settings.py file cleaner, essentially, is what it comes down to.
Nice. All right. Well, thanks for bringing all these news items, articles, and projects this week, Chris. It's good to talk to you.
Always good to be here.
Thanks again to Ori by Endor Labs for sponsoring this episode. If your AI coding agent is writing code faster than you can review it, Ori gives it the security context to ship safely by default. Free for developers, 60 seconds to set up. Links in the show notes. I want to say thanks to Christopher Trudeau for coming on the show again this week. And I want to thank you for listening. If you like the episode, a great way to help us grow our audience is to share it with other Python users who you think might enjoy it. You can also leave a rating or a review on your podcast platform of choice. If you or your company are interested in sponsoring the podcast, you can find all the information at realpython.com/advertise. You can find show notes with links to the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.